than crazy. Desperate to be a star. Oh, but I got up somehow and scrubbed most of it away. Left a little funk on me so I'd be stronger on this day. No shtick. Still love Dick. I can joke about my sex addiction now, but trust me, there was nothing funny about it. It was sick, compulsive, dangerous behavior. My discussions with Rachel about depression, mania, and sex addiction were extremely painful. But Rachel said if I made a commitment to stay with the healing process through the long haul, I could, in fact, become a joyful person. Joy. I made other people laugh for a living, but I had never actually considered that I had a right to full-out happiness myself. Rachel suggested that I begin journaling. I told her, well, you know, I've been keeping a diary all my life. Rachel said, really? That's probably one of the things that saved you. Expressing my thoughts and feelings on paper was one of the best habits I had developed on my own. I wrote, doodled, and drew in my journals, chronicling my experiences, sorting out my problems, writing my history. I could always be more adventurous when I was alone. Every day was a different drama. When you live in that drama, you stay in that drama. It becomes a habit. My journal entries were dramatic, but at least they were honest. Now Rachel wanted me to process it all. My sessions with Rachel transformed my journaling and doodling from pastimes into actual tools I could strategically employ to help myself through the difficult process of getting well, to write about my painful feelings, to illustrate them in many colors, would help me to experience them more deeply. Fully feeling and acknowledging my painful feelings could prevent me from acting them out, either toward others or myself. My journals from this period show how I was my own harshest critic. I contradicted myself at every turn. Being manic and crazy one minute, then grown up, realistic, and even wise the next. Journal entry. It's not so much stardom I want anymore, as it is that I just want to feel better, be better. I want to stop trying to prove I am somebody and be somebody. I'm dramatic even as I write this. Let go, baby. Nobody's gonna hurt you anymore. Becoming a star was once my highest goal. My talent for entertaining people, making magic with my voice, and my whole self as a performing artist was the gift God gave me above everything else in life. I thought if I worked hard enough, the challenges God gave me, poverty, abuse, lovelessness, would all fade away. I had been in therapy just a few months when Mama sent me a printed program from an event at her church. When I saw Pastor Hurd's name, every cell in my body reacted. A numbing sensation engulfed me. I went out and bought a bottle of hard liquor. I got drunk. I held myself together enough to call Mama and ask for Hurd's number. She hesitated. So I said, I want to ask him about a scripture. I knew she knew his number by heart. I called Pastor Hurd. Hello. This is Jennifer. Hello, Jennifer. We saw you on television. Oh, we're all so proud of you. It ain't that kind of call, motherfucker. He was silent. You still fucking with little girls in your church? Listen to me. You hang up this phone. I'll fly there and kill you. Why did you do what you did to me? When I kissed you, Jennifer, I was trying to show you what you might run into in Hollywood. You sick, twisted motherfucker. Do you realize in those 10 seconds that you touched my body, kissed me, and felt me up? You took everything from me. And you still call yourself a man of God. Just know, if you don't let me get this out, I will blow your stupid, pathetic little church to pieces with you in it. Am I allowed one word? What, bitch? Sorry. I am sorry. I continued to attack him and wanted to tell him to go straight to hell. But strangely, I felt his remorse. His apology did not lessen my disgust for him or rectify the damage he had done to me. But confronting him was liberating. My conversations with Rachel about the molestation became easier. Ultimately, after many, many months, I was able to come to terms with the molestation, to acknowledge that it was evil, to feel my anger and sadness about it, and to recognize that it was not my fault. Y'all, confronting Pastor Hurd felt so good in terms of standing up for myself as a woman. I promised myself never to keep another secret. And I want other women to know they can stand up and must stand up to your persecutors. Feel the fear and do it anyway. We are all as sick as our secrets, y'all. Remember that shit. In early December, I flew to Columbia, Missouri to perform in a short run of Ain't Misbehavin'. When I picked up the phone in my hotel room late one night, it was Mama. Hello? Jenny, your daddy's dead. When can you come home? I was devastated by the heartless way in which my mother told me of my father's demise. She had once told me she detested him. But it was me she hurt. He was my daddy, and she was not respecting my feelings. I rented a car and drove the 2 hours to St. Louis for my father's funeral. I've never known a funeral that didn't bring surprises. When I walked in the house, I recognized everyone in the family except one person, a 10-year-old boy who looked just like my father. My family had received him with open arms, and so did I. The funeral was sad. Having not really known my father, I was unclear about what I felt or should feel. Some of my siblings were closer to him, and I spent most of my time comforting them. My mother sat in the front row at the funeral service, of course. Though they had been separated for 33 years, they never divorced. So there she sat in a full-length mink coat, while the mother of the young son sat in the back of the church. The morning of my father's funeral, Mark Brown called and told Mama that Quitman had died. Thank God Mama was merciful enough to hold the news until the repast after the service. I went into the old bedroom that was once mine. I curled up on my old bed. Surprisingly, I smiled at first. God help me, remembering every salad Quitman had made, every piece of toast he had meticulously spread butter on, careful not to miss a spot, every tight T-shirt he had squeezed his perfectly formed body into. I lay there and could still feel the deep compassion he showered on me when I'd burst into his apartment wailing about some lost man, some lost audition, some note I couldn't hit, some lyric I had missed. But when my mind wandered back to that last time I had seen him, and those purple lesions covering my baby's face, I lost complete control and sobbed into the night. Rest in peace, baby. They'll never tell you no again. Nobody will ever call you a nigger again. And all the suffering is over. I will love you into forever. I returned to Columbia, Missouri to finish the run of Ain't Misbehavin'. When the show closed, I went back to Kinloch and confronted my mother for the first time in my life. I had learned a few things in therapy. One, to protect myself. Two, not to let horrible things invade me to the point I would lapse into a deep depression. And three, just tell the truth and get the shit out on the table. I used the courage therapy was giving me to confront my mother. She was washing dishes. I said, "Mama, the way you told me Daddy died was not right. It was the only way I knew to tell you. I didn't feel that was apologetic enough. And after months of working on myself in therapy, I was not afraid to let her know how I truly felt. I had come to understand that my fear of my mother was no longer necessary, because she was the one who was really afraid. As we stood over the kitchen sink, I looked her dead in her eyes and said, "Mama, I'm gonna ask you, if something happens to one of my sisters or brothers, please tell me to sit down first, or warn me that you have some bad news." I don't think anyone had ever talked to my mother like that, and frankly, she was not fazed. But after so many hours discussing my mother with Rachel, I understood that my mother could never admit she had been wrong, 'cause then she would have to feel remorse. Her life, her circumstances, had mostly blotted out all feelings but anger or disdain. Perhaps it was survival. I tried not to judge her, but I had made my feelings known, and I could now choose to be my own self. I was growing up and went back to Los Angeles proud of myself. Rachel suggested I try to resolve some of my issues by writing letters. She told me, "You don't have to mail them, but sit with your feelings. You can burn them afterwards if you want." I wrote everybody I could think of, avoiding my mother. However, after several more sessions, I finally conjured up the nerve. As Rachel had promised, putting my feelings in a letter was very helpful. A few days later, I read her the letter. "You worked very hard to keep us fed and clean. And I appreciate that very much, Mama. You sent me to school, but you never checked to see if I was learning anything. Where were you, Mama? I don't even remember you helping me with homework, nor sitting and just talking to me about anything. You only demanded this, beat me for that, then you went to your room. You just used us to serve you, to worship you, like animals without souls. I had a soul, Mama. I was a child. You were supposed to love me, not beat me at every turn. I've been wanting to write you for a long time. Talking on the phone about these issues doesn't work for me because I just slip into being a child. And the child in me is afraid of you because of the physical abuse and lack of compassion you imposed on me, Mama. I knew that what I had to say to Mama would hit her hard. Our instinct is to protect our mothers. But therapy had eliminated those blinders and allowed me to see that Mama had a responsibility to deal with the truth. She hated that I used the word abuse. She didn't think of her tough love and no-nonsense discipline as abusing her child. Our family had inherited Grandma Neal's rage, Grandma Small's rage, the ancestral memory of rapes, molestations, betrayals, theft, lies, and secrets. But as Maya Angelou said, when you know better, you do better. Or you should at least try. The letter went on. I have suffered unspeakable neurosis and psychosis. I've been a manic depressive for years. Your rage made me unable to have healthy relationships with anyone, let alone a man. I questioned whether her motive for sending me off to school a year early was as much to get me out of her way as it was to assure that I would have a good future. My words were harsh, but genuine. I saw her as a monster. And I used that word. I said that she raised us like animals. I went there, and it was hurtful. But in my mind, it matched how she hurt me. Something horrible must have happened to you, Mama. What? I now know many things, and I assume other things I don't want to imagine. You buried us in the Baptist church, I wrote, and I talked about Pastor Hurd. Surely if we'd ever had a mother, we lost you then. You poured your existence into this fucking man. Mama, did you know he, in different ways, tried to seduce or molest many of the girls at the church? I accused her of being so desperate to be somebody to him and the church that she overlooked what he was doing to the women in the congregation. To this day, you sit up in his church listening to this man refer to women as whores if they have sex before marriage. And yet, I told Mama she should have gotten help. Suggesting that she was emotionally and mentally ill as well. I didn't consider that in the time and place where I grew up, there was no mental health system, no social safety net. Even among educated people, psychiatry was suspect. Being mentally ill was something else you kept secret. If you could. If you couldn't, you suffered on top of the condition, being shamed and treated even worse by your family and neighbors. Nobody wants to be called crazy, for real. Then I shared something she didn't know. I became one of the biggest whores I could, Mama. I've slept with over 60 men. You see, I felt you gave me away to Hurd. If you didn't care, why should I? I threw away my life. I blocked my childhood. I numbed out to survive. I told Mama that therapy had led me to an important realization about my career. Every time I'd get close to success, subconsciously, I'd sabotage it just to hurt you. Because my success would make you happy. Deep down inside, I hated you because I felt you hated me. Couldn't you see how unhappy we were? Can't you see it even now? I'm just now getting myself together to start living, not just surviving. Laughing and not pretending, learning and not running away from my problems. Mama, this process is so painful. I close the letter with a plea for her honesty and respect. When I finished reading, Rachel said, "Good work. Now it's your choice if you want to mail it. This is your work, Jennifer. Your decision." The letter was an incredible release, a breakthrough. I decided to send the letter. For more than 2 hours, I sat in the parking lot at the post office, holding 7 letters, one for Mama, and copies of the same letter for each of my siblings. We think we're going to kill our parents by confronting them. But people, including our parents, are often very much able to hear the truth. They may not take it well, but nobody dies from honesty. The first time Mama and I talked on the phone after she received the letter, she was subdued. She called back the next day and we wound up screaming at each other. My siblings gave me varying responses. One sister didn't have memory of a lot of the behavior I described and was not having it. She didn't want anything bad said about Mama. A few of them agreed and were pleased that I led the charge because they weren't ready to. Bebra didn't want any drama and reminded me that everybody got a beating in Kenlock. He said, "You leave Mama alone, Jenny." I actually expected harsher blowback because where I come from, you can't talk about people's mama. Unless you're playing the dozens, and then you better be super funny. But at some point, you have to tell the truth. The letter did accomplish a few things. First, it ushered in a new level of respect among me, my siblings, and my mother. It opened new lines of communication, and the family began to have meetings to air out repressed secrets and emotions. I joined by phone. The letter was a big accomplishment for me. Proof that I was learning to feel the fear and do it anyway. Mama didn't change at all, but she did at least listen to what we had to say about the whole matter. Months passed before I was back in Missouri for Christmas. I was grateful that no one brought up the letter. I had relative peace in my mama's house during the visit. After all, how much can we all take at the holidays? They're stressful enough. 11. Dismissing the diva. Within the year, My sessions with Rachel increased to twice a week. As the hours of therapy added up, I was becoming better at identifying and managing my feelings. My sex addiction lessened. When I'd begun therapy, my lovers were Tim, Adam, and an actor named Sam, who, let's just say, liked it from the side. And Roger. I still enjoyed sex, but felt less compelled to use it as a way to feel better. I relished being more in control of myself. I had relapses. No trajectory is straight, and we fall back on bullshit excuses, fear, and confusion. Rachel called it dropping the ball. I would also throw the occasional pity party for myself. Journal entry. I have no baby, no man, no show. Fuck 'em. On the other hand, I was determined to get well. As proof of my resolve, I kept my resolutions for the new year. Starting in January 1991, I went 19 days without a cigarette and 167 days without sex. By the end, I felt hopeful. I was doing hatha yoga twice a week, played racquetball, and doing aerobics at the gym. I worked on myself, but it was a circuitous journey. I still sobbed at night and had nightmares about Pastor Hurd wanting to fuck me on a piano stool. Having Rachel in my corner made a huge difference, but it was clear to us both that I had a long way to go. I went to a party at Mark Shaman's house and got drunker than I had ever been. Bette Midler was there. And I sort of swaggered over to her and breathed red wine fumes in her face. And real loud, I said, "Why don't you take care of your harlots, Bet?" Needless to say, she left the party immediately. It was horrible. I was rude, loud, and ridiculous. I did a lot of apologizing the next day to many, many friends, especially Bette. She definitely did not deserve to be on the receiving end of my acting out. Living with my own bad behavior was painful enough, but then I was obliged to tell Rachel about the incident. Openness and honesty with your doctor is crucial to healing. But it can be so damn hard. "How much did you drink?" Rachel asked. I didn't admit to her how much I really drank at that party. I couldn't. She cut me no slack on what I actually did admit to her. She helped me to further understand how to avoid a repeat of the situation, to recognize the warning signals. We discussed how I might shortcut my insecurities before they led me to do something I'd regret and dig myself into an emotional hole. I was so ashamed of myself. I was pretty good to my body, eating clean, working out. As an actor, my body is an instrument, and with that in mind, I practiced a healthy lifestyle during the week. But I was challenged by the lack of structure a 9-to-5 kind of job provides. Actors work long hours when we're working, but we have lots of time to fill between jobs without always knowing how. Idle hours made room for too much drama, getting into everybody's and your own shit. You get into trouble, and when you find yourself in trouble and causing trouble, you still have to come clean and tell the truth to your therapist. Feel the fear. and tell the truth to yourself. During the 2 years I'd been in treatment with Rachel, she had shown herself to be a sensitive and compassionate person, yet I was unable to look her in the eye when we talked. I had trust issues and fear. I was afraid that my wounds were so deep that no one, certainly not me, could heal them. I was slowly warming to her, but not completely. Some sessions were better than others. On my good days, I was talking more and more, exploring issues of intimacy, or rather, the lack of intimacy I had growing up. I was self-reflective. I learned that feelings of omnipotence and displays of grandiosity occurred because inside I felt unworthy most of the time. I pondered my patterns of selecting men to date who were really sad little boys. I guess the reason was that I was a sad little girl. As I grew and learned, my inner diva was summarily dismissed and effectively humbled. My new reality informed the title for my new one-woman show, an autobiographical comedy and music show, The Diva is Dismissed. There were never enough opportunities for me in the industry, so when they didn't call, I wrote my own stuff. I wanted to work, tell my story, show what I could do. I enlisted the help of my brilliant and talented friends, writer-director Charles Randolph Wright, Mark Alton Brown, and music director Michael Skloff. The show was about the search for self, about removing the diva mask and becoming an authentic person. It chronicled my failed relationships, my journey from New York City to Los Angeles, and my difficulties transitioning from live performance to television and film. Ultimately, the diva character, who is me, acknowledges, I didn't want to hurt anybody. I just wanted to be somebody. Lyrics for the show included, I got to climb this mountain, and it's big, scary, and tall. I got to climb this mountain, I don't want to fall. But what I got to understand is that it's okay to take a hand. I got to climb this mountain of love. We opened at Offline, a lovely turn-of-the-century bungalow that had been converted into a relaxed yet elegant restaurant in Hollywood. We chose a non-traditional venue because we wanted the show to feel sort of underground, something special, something different. It was a great success with audiences and critics. After a few months, we took the show to the Hudson Backstage Theater on Santa Monica Boulevard. We ran there every Sunday evening for about 7 months. The production never would have made it to a theater like the Hudson without gay Iris Parker, one of the gentlest and purest people I'd ever known. Gay was a publicist for the Pasadena Playhouse. She saw my show at Offline and then pulled some strings at the Hudson. I was very grateful for what she did for me. Gay became a close friend, a confidant, who loved my crazy ass through 17 years of sisterhood until she passed away. My one-woman shows have earned me my most loyal fans over the years, especially among my fellow artists. When Sidney Poitier saw the show, he said, My daughter told me that you were wonderful. My dear, that was an understatement. You are fucking magnificent. Thank God someone was there to catch me when my knees buckled. We sold out every Sunday night. People crammed into the 99-seat theater. There were nights when I heard the stage manager say, "They're fighting over the seats out there." I lost track of the many celebrities and actors who saw the show. Lee Daniels, Chris Calloway, Malcolm Jamal Warner, Jackie Collins, Sandy Gallen, Mavis Staples, Shirley Ralph, Rosie O'Donnell, B.B. Newworth, Denzel and Pauletta Washington, Carol Lawrence, Bette Midler, Felicia Rashad, and B. Arthur all came to see me. Some of the show business big shots who saw what I could do offered me work. Director Lee Rose was in the house one night and went on to cast me in 3 of her movies. Seeing Lena Horne in the audience one evening, I didn't even exit the stage when I finished. I just ran into the audience and hugged her so tight. She whispered in my ear, "You're the fucking best." Seems the word fucking comes up a lot when people describe me. My friend Atala Shabazz, the eldest daughter of Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz, brought Nina Simone backstage to meet me. Miss Simone was draped in what looked like a monkey coat. She extended her hand and in her deep, rich tone said, "Hello, I'm Nina Simone." I grabbed that monkey arm and pulled her to me. "Bitch, I know your name. I know every lick on every fucking album you've ever made. I am you. You made me." Miss Simone drew back, and Atala interjected, "It's time to go." I was deeply distressed, thinking somehow I had insulted this goddess whom I revere with my total soul. Later that evening, Atala called and said, "Nina praised your performance the entire way home and pledged that she would come out of her retirement and return to the stage because of what she had just witnessed." Paula Kelly, who had starred in Sweet Charity with Shirley MacLaine and Cheetah Rivera, was in attendance one Sunday. As I started to sing a Stevie Wonder song, "They Won't Go When I Go," I could hear her humming and singing along with me. I looked at her in the audience and smiled. It was a cue to all the other gypsies and singers in the audience to join me. They knew I was singing about the many people we'd lost to AIDS. Never in my life had I experienced something so loving and supporting, so uplifting and beautiful. I was supposed to climb some stairs at the end of the song, and let's just say their harmony made me believe I could fly. In 1992, a horrible thing happened. 704 Hauser. It was a late spinoff of All in the Family, about a black family that was to occupy the row house the Bunkers had lived in. Television legend Norman Lear, who'd seen The Divas Dismissed, said he wanted to cast me in the lead role. I worked with Lear on the script and the character, even going to his house. I started to see him as a father figure. I just knew he was going to make me the next Maud. But lo and behold, he gave the part to Lenny Godfrey, with whom I'd done You Be on Broadway. He offered me a small role, which I declined. It was a cruel Hollywood nightmare. George C. Wolfe saw The Divas Dismissed in Los Angeles and invited me to do the show at the esteemed Public Theater in New York City. We opened in October 1994 to rave reviews. Variety wrote, "Jennifer Lewis could no more give up divahood than she could give away her big, rich voice." Stage Review said, "Lewis commands the stage, not only with her explosive personality and infectious humor, but with a glimmering jewel of a voice." This was an amazing time. Everyone from Morgan Freeman to Ashford and Simpson to Josephine Premise and Madonna. Everybody showed up to see me at the Public. I won the NAACP Theater Award for The Divas Dismissed, and I won an Ovation Award for the production later on. Norman Lear heard about my success in New York and called to congratulate me. I proceeded to tell him, "Please, don't ever call my phone again." I would swim every evening before the show. My diet had to change completely in order to deliver the goods at the theater. This was not TV or film. This shit was live and in person. You either step up or it will eat you alive. I thought about seducing the hunky lifeguard at the pool, but then I would have to tell Rachel, bitch. I was throwing temper tantrums in my phone sessions with Rachel. I was getting tired of analyzing every goddamn thing I did. I was working hard on my abandonment issues during this time. The grind of diva was taking its toll on me. I only had a few more weeks, but it was cold in New York, and my voice was starting to go. And damn if I didn't catch an all-out flu. I slipped into a full-blown, woe-is-me depression. One day, I believe for the first time in my life, I just couldn't get myself together. Mentally, physically, or emotionally, to get to the theater. It was really a bad day for me. I called Rachel from my apartment and told her, "I just don't think I can do it." She said, "Yes, you can." I walked out into the freezing cold. I had always walked to the theater at a fast pace to warm up my lungs. This time I walked 2 blocks, and my legs felt heavy. My heart sad. My will faltering. Every 3 blocks, I had to stop at a phone booth to call Rachel for more encouragement, just to keep moving and get to the theater and do my job. I knew better than anyone in the world that the show must go on. I applied my makeup through tears that evening. The standing ovation did not uplift my spirit. New Year's Eve was closing night, and what a late Christmas present to have Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis attend. I apologized to Ruby that my voice had been hoarse. She said, in her fabulous Ruby Dee slur, "Well, I didn't have anything to compare it to. I thought it was wonderful." I joined Felicia Richard and a few others for a New Year's Eve celebration at Cafe Beulah. I went to the ladies' room, and as I rejoined everyone at the table, I asked them, "Are you guys talking about the show?" Lynn Whitfield said, "Jennifer, I'm going to tell you like I tell my daughter, Grace. It's not always about you. I looked at her and whispered, Oh, yes it is, bitch. And Happy New Year to you, too. Back on the West Coast that spring, I was doing my act at clubs like Nucleus Nuance and the Rose Tattoo. In the early 90s, lots of New York gypsies had moved to Los Angeles to take advantage of the surge of black sitcoms. They all showed up for my shows. The political climate got hot in Los Angeles. Rodney King, a black man, was beaten by police on video. It became international news. Riots broke out in the South Central area in the aftermath when an all-white jury acquitted the cops involved in the brutality. Like so many people, I was deeply concerned by what I saw in that video and how the authorities handled the matter. It was stressful, to say the least. My urge was to do something to help. The horror of that incident and everything else I was going through in my life caused me to break out in hives. Even with all that itching, I was determined to go to South Central. It was the least I could do to volunteer to help clean up the rubble left by the rioting. It was me and five young white kids sweeping together. At some point, a homeless man approached us and screamed, You motherfuckers never come down here for nothing else. I stepped to him and said, Get the fuck on where you going? I felt bad. He could have been my own daddy. I soon turned my attention back to my life and work. I auditioned for I'll Fly Away, and Regina Taylor got it. I auditioned for Passenger 57, and Alex Datcher got it. My over-the-topness was still an issue. A big mouth and a deep back bend weren't cutting it in television. I auditioned for Against the Law and Family Matters, and didn't get hired for either one. I wanted to win at show business, but toning myself down for work in front of the camera was difficult. I could go from 0 to 10,000 in a minute, and was still experiencing mood swings and rageful incidents. Like when I was in a restaurant in London with my friend Tom Fennessy, and a man next to us was speaking too loudly. I almost took the guy's head off. Every now and then, I would still fuck up with people I love the most. And they loved me enough to tell me when I did. My beloved Mark Shaman invited me to an event. I showed up after it was all over. I hadn't understood that it was a commitment ceremony with his partner, Scott Whitman. Hurt and furious, Scott read me the riot act the next day. All I could say was, I'm still working on myself, Scott. And I am so fucking sorry. These were very close friends I had disappointed. I felt horrible. Therapy became harder and harder. I was digging up memories, reaching down to rediscover the tough and tender stuff of my childhood. I threatened to leave many times. Rachel recommended I see a psychiatrist who could prescribe medication to level off my extreme moods. I looked at her as if she were insane. You aren't putting me on medication. I'm Jennifer motherfucking Lewis. You aren't going to turn me into a zombie. I feared medication would take away my personality and restrain my ability to express emotions. Rachel wrote something down, and I'm sure she went to see her shrink right after I left. My negative attitude toward pharmaceuticals was affirmed by one psychiatrist Rachel sent me to. At his office, I saw a girl at the dispensary asking for her lithium. She looked out of it, like fucked up. That stuck in my mind. I didn't want to be sluggish and dull like that. The psychiatrist said he didn't see anything wrong with my edge, referring to my mania. You need that to do what you do. He was right, in the sense that performers are rewarded for being over the top, with boundless energy and extreme emotions. I decided against taking medication. My point is that even health experts can have different opinions and come to different conclusions about the same patient. This makes it all the more important for us patients to take charge of our own health care. We have to seek varying sources of information and advice. And most of all, we have to listen to our own bodies. You must pay attention to your symptoms and responses. It takes patience and diligence, but it's the key to helping your doctors help you. I started to read more books about mental health and got back into spiritual books. Women Who Run with the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes touched me and many other women deeply. The book presented ideas on the power and strength of women and puts the wild woman that is within each of us in a positive light. I, a self-proclaimed alpha woman, was attracted to this message. Hillary Clinton wrote a book that impressed me as well, It Takes a Village. The book refers to an African proverb about what it takes to raise a child. But the idea can be applied to taking care of all people in general, and me specifically. I was saved by the fact that I was surrounded by a village of good people, including my family, therapists, and friends, and of course, the boat. My family may have been dysfunctional in my youth, but we loved each other, and we were never far apart for long. My friends were not only brilliant and talented, they showed me love and support, even in my darkest times. When you're not at your best, surround yourself with good people. In terms of my career, the better I understood myself and managed the bipolar illness, the more offers came my way, including Undercover Blues with Dennis Quaid and an HBO show, Dream On. Debbie Allen, oh, fabulous one, swooped in and gave me a huge boost by asking me to become a regular on A Different World, playing Dean Dorothy Dandridge Davenport. That meant my name would appear in the opening titles, and I would be guaranteed a minimum number of episodes during the season. Cree Summer, who played a character named Freddie Brooks, and I started hanging out a lot. The depth of our inside ridiculous humor cannot be described. Let's just say we were cutting the fool every moment we were together hiking in the hills. The icing on the cake was that I did Johnny Carson's Last Tonight Show with Bette Midler. I had always dreamt of being on Johnny Carson's show. I found it amazing that I was booked on the very last show with Bette Midler singing an upbeat rendition of Miss Otis Regrets. Ella Fitzgerald was known for her slower, mournful version. And our dear Mark Shaman was on the piano. Life was complete. I was so damn happy. Robin Williams was on the show, too. I had always been a huge fan of his. But his behavior backstage is what I remember most. That night, he was in an extreme manic state. And in that moment, I saw myself. I became aware of how I failed to see anyone else when I was in that state. I felt unsettled. With all this good stuff going on, the roller coaster of happy, sad, happy, sad, it became intolerable. I just got sick and tired of it. I finally told Rachel I was ready to begin medication. But even with medication, my depression lingered. I was trying to create a more productive energy in my life, attending lectures on positive thinking and living in the moment. I started meditating again and trying to stop smoking. Rachel told me it revealed a lack of self-love. I auditioned for the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and was hired to play Aunt Helen. I was excited to get a prime time show that was already a hit. I had a blast working with the cast, y'all, especially Will Smith. Okay, one night backstage wearing a negligee, Will, with his big old ears, saw me and said, "Ooh, you look good." As always, he had a bunch of groupies hovering nearby. I motioned at him and said, "Come here." I pointed to the young women. "You see all those little girls down there? Now you go on and flirt with them, okay? Because if you flirt with me, I'll fuck you." In typical Will fashion, his response was, uh-oh, and then he laughingly told everyone the story. It was a bonding experience, and he became quite protective of me. Our mutual admiration for each other's talent made it a joy to work on the show. I started hanging out with Janet Hubert, who played my sister and Will's Aunt Viv on the show. Let's just say Miss Hubert was not having any of it from anybody at any time. I was coming from a boat meeting one night, and some kids decided they would roll a grocery cart out in front of my little white Mazda 323. There was no way I could hit the brakes in time, but when I pulled over, it was a relief to see my car had only minimal damage. I wanted to report the incident to the police and walk toward the nearest home to see if I could use someone's phone. Just as I pressed the doorbell, I heard glass shatter, and I turned to see one of the kids reach in my passenger window, steal my purse off the front seat, and take off running. Damn, I was mad. But having been a little thief myself in my youth, I knew they only wanted the cash and would throw the purse away. The following day, I went back to the scene of the crime and put myself in the thieves' mind. Where would I have thrown that purse? I mounted a concrete wall to the back of an apartment building, climbed across the balcony, and up onto the roof. I retrieved my purse and took my black ass home. I saw a couple of other purses up there, too. The next day, I had therapy, and then was supposed to go to an audition for which I'd been studying for days. I told Rachel I planned to skip the audition because my car window was broken and we were being hit hard by the rains of El Nino. She was not having it and told me I would be going to the audition. I drove all the way to Culver City.